acquired a strong taste for music, Charles Darwin once wrote, so that when listening to an anthem, my backbone would sometimes shiver. But it's not just that a certain kind of original person seeks out exposure to the arts. The arts also serve in turn as a powerful source of creative insight. When Galileo made his astonishing discovery of mountains on the moon, his telescope didn't actually have enough magnifying power to support that finding. Instead, he recognized the zigzag pattern separating the light and dark areas of the moon. Other astronomers were looking through similar telescopes, but only Galileo was able to appreciate the implications of the dark and light regions, Simonton notes. He had the necessary depth of experience in physics and astronomy, but also breadth of experience in painting and drawing. Thanks to artistic training in a technique called chiaroscuro, which focuses on representations of light and shade, Galileo was able to detect mountains where others did not. Just as scientists, entrepreneurs, and inventors often discover novel ideas through broadening their knowledge to include the arts, we can likewise gain breadth by widening our cultural repertoires. Research on highly creative adults shows that they tended to move to new cities much more frequently than their peers in childhood, which gave them exposure to different cultures and values, and encouraged flexibility and adaptability. In a recent study, a team of researchers led by strategy professor Frédéric Godard explored whether creativity might be influenced by time spent abroad. They focused on the fashion industry, tracking ratings from buyers and fashion critics of the creativity of collections produced by hundreds of fashion houses over the course of 21 seasons. The researchers studied the creative directors' biographies, tracking the international experiences of industry icons like Giorgio Armani, Donna Karan, Karl Lagerfeld, Donatella Versace, and Vera Wang. The most creative fashion collections came from houses where directors had the greatest experience abroad, but there were three twists. First, time living abroad didn't matter. It was time working abroad, being actively engaged in design in a foreign country, that predicted whether their new collections were hits. The most original collections came from directors who had worked in two or three different countries. Second, the more the foreign culture differed from that of their native land, the more that experience contributed to the director's creativity. An American gained little from working in Canada, compared to the originality dividends of a project in Korea or Japan. But working in multiple countries with different cultures wasn't enough. The third and most important factor was depth, the amount of time spent working abroad. A short stint did little good because directors weren't there long enough to internalize the new ideas from the foreign culture and synthesize them with their old perspectives. The highest originality occurred when directors had spent 35 years working abroad. Rick Ludwin's experience lines up with this model. He had depth from spending well over a decade working on different comedy sketches. He had breadth from living in the television equivalents of several very different foreign countries, variety and specials, and daytime and late-night talk shows. Having become fluent in multiple television languages, he saw promise where others had doubts. Once he got Seinfeld approved, Ludwin continued to oversee the show for the entire series, and he bet on writers who had the same insider-outsider status that he did. Almost all came from late night, and most had never worked on a sitcom before Seinfeld, which meant there was never a problem with offbeat ideas. Do diverse experiences really generate originality, or do original people seek out diverse experiences? In fashion houses, perhaps the most creative directors would choose to immerse themselves in new cultures for the longest periods of time. This might be part of the story, but there's evidence that variety of experience can foster creativity. When we diversify our knowledge base, we're more likely to sample original ideas and retrieve unconventional knowledge, Studies show that people become more creative when reminded of time they spent living in a foreign culture. And bilinguals tend to be more creative than people who speak only a single language. And in one experiment, when European Americans watched a 45-minute slideshow about American-Chinese fusion culture, they wrote more creative Cinderella stories for Turkish children than peers who learned only about American or Chinese culture. The Hazards of Intuition, where Steve Jobs went wrong. The first time Steve Jobs stepped on a Segway, he refused to climb off. When Dean Kamen gave other potential investors a turn, Jobs begrudgingly handed it over, but soon cut in. Jobs invited Kamen over for dinner, and as journalist Steve Kemper tells it, Jobs thought the machine was as original and enthralling as the PC, and felt he had to be involved. Steve Jobs was famous for making big bets based on intuition rather than systematic analysis. Why was he right so often in software and hardware, but wrong this time? Three major forces left him overconfident about the Segway's potential: domain inexperience, hubris, and enthusiasm. Let's start with experience. Whereas many NBC executives were too experienced in traditional sitcoms to appreciate the unorthodox genius of Seinfeld, the Segway's early investors had the opposite problem. They didn't know enough about transportation. Jobs specialized in the digital world. Jeff Bezos was the king of internet retail, and John Doerr had made his fortune investing in software and internet companies like Sun Microsystems, Netscape, Amazon, and Google. They had all been originals in their respective arenas, but being a creator in one particular area doesn't make you a great forecaster in others. To accurately predict the success of a novel idea, it's best to be a creator in the domain you're judging. New research led by Eric Dane shows us why. Our intuitions are only accurate in domains where we have a lot of experience. In one experiment, people looked at 10 designer handbags and judged whether they were real or fake. Half the participants had only 5 seconds to guess, which forced them to rely on their gut feelings. The other half had 30 seconds, which allowed them to inspect and analyze the features. Dane's team also measured their handbag experience. Some had a lot, owning more than 3 handbags made by Coach or Louis Vuitton, whereas others had never touched a designer bag. If you're the proud owner of several designer handbags, the less time you have to inspect them, the more accurate your judgments. Experienced handbag owners were 22% more accurate when they had just 5 seconds than when they had 30 seconds. When you've spent years studying handbags, intuition can beat analysis, because your unconscious mind excels at pattern recognition. If you stop and take the time to think, it's easy to lose the forest in the trees. If you don't know anything about handbags, however, your intuition isn't going to help you. In dealing with unfamiliar products, you need to take a step back and assess them. Non-experts make sounder judgments when they conduct a thorough analysis. When Steve Jobs had a gut feeling that the Segway would change the world, he was seduced by an impulsive attraction to its novelty, rather than a careful examination of its usefulness. Harvard psychologist Teresa Amabile, one of the world's foremost authorities on creativity, reminds us that to be successfully original, an invention needs to be new, but it also has to be practical. In a digital world dominated by invisible bits and bytes, Jobs was enamored with the possibility that the next breakthrough innovation would be in transportation. The Segway was an engineering marvel, and riding it was a thrill. It was like a magic carpet. It was transformational as a product, says Bill Salmon, the Harvard entrepreneurship professor who introduced Kamen to Doerr. But products don't create value. Customers do. For a group of people with no transportation experience, a lot of homework was required to figure out whether the Segway was actually practical. One of the few investors to raise concerns in that area was Eileen Lee, then an associate partner working for Dorr at Kleiner Perkins. In board meetings, Lee asked questions about how the Segway would be used. How would you lock it? Where would you store groceries? She had another big practical concern, the price tag, since $5,000 or $8,000 is a lot of money for a normal person. Looking back, she says, I should have stood up more and said, we aren't getting this right. Another early skeptic was Randy Komisar, who had been an entrepreneur, senior counsel at Apple, CEO at LucasArts Entertainment, and a founding board member at TiVo. I think about it as if I was in that seat with the entrepreneur. I don't think I'm smarter than those guys, but I saw something differently than they did. I think they saw a brilliant technology in an application that seemed extremely novel. When we got on the machines that day, it was a magical experience to be on two wheels, self-balancing, moving around, Komisar recalls. That first impression was a wow experience. Now, why did I not get convinced by that? When Komisar scrutinized the market, he saw that the Segway wasn't likely to replace the car, but would be a substitute for walking or riding a bike. He didn't view it as a product for ordinary consumers. It's a huge change of behavior at a very high expense with limited value beyond the wow factor for anybody with 2 feet, he explains. Even if it was approved for use on sidewalks, which was still an open question, and the price point became affordable, it would take years to get people on board. He suggested instead focusing on the device's usefulness for golf courses, postal services, police departments, and Disney parks. You could see that there was a cost-value trade-off in those applications, where this might have some advantages. But Komisar continued to have serious reservations. I still looked at it as a very significant change of behavior at a very significant cost. It wasn't clear to me that this would improve a mail carrier's productivity, or that that was the goal for the Postal Service, which was pretty much hamstrung by labor union contracts. On the golf course, people drive electric carts around all day long. Why will they use this instead? Jobs, meanwhile, stuck to his intuition about novelty. If enough people see the machine, you won't have to convince them to architect cities around it. People are smart, and it'll happen. As Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman and decision expert Gary Klein explain, intuitions are only trustworthy when people build up experience making judgments in a predictable environment. If you're confronting a patient's symptoms as a doctor or entering a burning building as a firefighter, experience will make your intuitions more accurate. There's a stable, robust relationship between the patterns you've seen before and what you encounter today. But if you're a stockbroker or political forecaster, the events of the past don't have reliable implications for the present. Kahneman and Klein review evidence that experience helps physicists, accountants, insurance analysts, and chess masters. They all work in fields where cause and effect relationships are fairly consistent. But admissions officers, court judges, intelligence analysts, psychiatrists, and stockbrokers didn't benefit much from experience. In a rapidly changing world, the lessons of experience can easily point us in the wrong direction. And because the pace of change is accelerating, our environments are becoming ever more unpredictable. This makes intuition less reliable as a source of insight about new ideas and places a growing premium on analysis. Given that Jobs hadn't accumulated the relevant experience in transportation, why was he so trusting of his intuition? This brings us to the second factor. There's a hubris that comes with success, Komisar explains. Had he pushed back harder about his concerns, Steve Jobs would have probably said, "You just don't get it." Research in the transportation and airline industries backs Komisar up. The more successful people have been in the past, the worse they perform when they enter a new environment. They become overconfident, and they're less likely to seek critical feedback even though the context is radically different. Jobs was in one of these success traps. With his track record and his history of proving naysayers wrong, he didn't bother to check his intuition by gathering input from enough creators with relevant domain knowledge. And his intuition led him further astray when he encountered Dean Kamen's presentation style. The Perils of Passion. When Kamen pitched the segue, he spoke passionately about how developing nations like China and India were building cities the size of New York every year. These urban centers were going to become clogged with cars, which are bad for our environment. The segue could solve this problem. "He's a force of nature," Eileen Lee remembers. "He's technical, experienced, and super passionate about these issues, so he is transfixing." In a study led by Northeastern University entrepreneurship professor Cheryl Mitness, more than 5 dozen angel investors made over 3,500 evaluations of entrepreneurs' pitches and decided whether or not to fund them. The investors filled out a survey about whether their own styles were more intuitive or analytical, rated each entrepreneur's passion and enthusiasm, and then evaluated the funding potential of each startup. The results showed that the more intuitive investors were, the greater their odds of being swayed by an entrepreneur's passion. As Daniel Kahneman explains in Thinking Fast and Slow, intuition operates rapidly, based on hot emotions, whereas reason is a slower, cooler process. Intuitive investors are susceptible to getting caught up in an entrepreneur's enthusiasm. Analytical investors are more likely to focus on the facts and make cold judgments about the viability of the business. Jobs's intuitive style predisposed him to get swept away by Kamen's passion and the inherent novelty of the technology, and his hubris and inexperience with transportation left him vulnerable to trusting what would eventually be revealed as a false positive. When assessing the prospects of a novel idea, it's all too easy to be seduced by the enthusiasm of the people behind it. In the words of Google executives Eric Schmidt and Jonathan Rosenberg, "Passionate people don't wear their passion on their sleeves. They have it in their hearts." The passion to see an idea to fruition isn't visible in the emotion people express. The enthusiasm we inject into our words, tone of voice, and body language isn't a clue to the internal passion we experience, but merely a reflection of our presentation skills and our personalities. For example, research shows that extroverts tend to be more expressive than introverts, which means that they display more passion. But whether we tend to be more extroverted or introverted has essentially no bearing on whether we'll succeed as entrepreneurs. You can love an idea and be determined to succeed, but still communicate it in a reserved manner. This isn't to say that passion is irrelevant to entrepreneurial success. There's plenty of evidence that passionate entrepreneurs are able to grow their ventures faster and more successfully. For his part, Kamen was lacking the element of passion that helps ideas grow from invention to impact. Instead of being enticed by his passion for creating the segue, the early investors should have assessed his passion for building a company and bringing the product successfully to market. And to do that, they shouldn't have only paid attention to what he said. They should have also examined what he did. After studying his history, Randy Komisar concluded that Kamen was a more impressive inventor than entrepreneur. In the past, Kamen's most successful inventions were a response to customers coming to him with a problem to solve. In the 1970s, he came up with the idea for the portable drug infusion pump when his brother, a doctor, lamented that nurses were constantly delivering medications by hand that should be automated, and many patients were stuck in hospitals when they could be receiving medication at home. In the 1980s, Kamen developed the portable dialysis machine after Baxter Healthcare hired his company to refine its kidney dialysis for diabetic patients. He excelled at creating brilliant solutions to problems identified by others, not in finding the right problems to solve. In the case of the segue, he started with a solution and then went hunting for a problem. Rather than responding to market pull, he made the mistake of initiating a technology push. Although Kamen was passionate about the Segway, he wasn't prepared to execute it successfully. If we want to improve our idea selection skills, we shouldn't look at whether people have been successful. We need to track how they've been successful. When we looked at Dean, we saw a credible founder who had a history of inventing successful medical devices, and the people he'd partnered with to make those products were still with him, Eileen Lee says. But when it came down to actually making the product, the day-to-day execution and making the product cost-effective was important. Kamen didn't have that experience. Bill Solomon adds, "It's never the idea, it's always the execution."
If we want to forecast whether the originators of a novel idea will make it successful,
we need to look beyond the enthusiasm they express about their ideas and focus on the enthusiasm for execution that they reveal through their actions. Rick Ludwin didn't bet on Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David because they looked or sounded passionate when they pitched their script, or even because they were genuinely excited about their concept for a show. He gave them a chance because he watched them revise their concept and observe their ability to get the execution right. They were the kinds of guys who would be in the writer's room trying to figure out how to fix the second act at midnight. You saw how meticulous Jerry was in his work. That's the passion you're looking for.
Corrective lenses for idea selection. My personal failure to invest in Warby Parker was a major false negative. After reading the research on idea selection, I recognized one of my limitations. I wasn't a fellow creator in the domain, nor was I a customer. At first, I blamed my poor creative forecasting on my 20/20 vision. When you've never owned a pair of glasses, it's awfully hard to gauge the preferences of people who do. But upon reflection, I realized that what I truly lacked was breadth. I had spent 2 years doing research and consulting for an eye care company whose primary source of revenue was selling glasses in store after optometrists provided prescriptions and customers tried them on. I was stuck in the default mindset of how glasses were traditionally bought and sold. Had I spent time generating ideas before hearing the pitch, or reading up on how other clothing and accessory products were sold online, I might have been more open to the idea. The four founders weren't hindered by these blinders. They had the right depth and breadth of experience. Three of them wore glasses and brought combined experience in bioengineering, healthcare, consulting, and banking. One of them, Dave, had lost his glasses while spending several months traveling abroad with no phone. When he came back to the United States, the need to buy a phone and glasses at the same time gave him a fresh perspective. Neil Blumenthal didn't wear glasses, but he had spent the past 5 years working at a nonprofit that trained women to start businesses in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. The product that he taught women to sell was eyeglasses. That gave him the necessary depth of knowledge in the optical industry. He knew that glasses could be manufactured, designed, and sold at a lower cost. And having spent time outside the conventional eyeglass channels, he had the breadth to adopt a fresh approach. "It's rare that originality comes from insiders," Neil tells me, "especially when they're as entrenched and comfortable as the optical industry." Because of the diversity of their experience, the Warby Parker entrepreneurs weren't hampered by existing prototypes or limited by evaluative mindsets. Instead of assuming that their idea would work and going into full-on enthusiastic sales mode like Kamen did, they first sought extensive feedback from fellow creators and potential customers. By cutting out the middleman of the retailer, they had determined that they could sell pairs of glasses that normally cost $500 for $45. After a marketing expert warned them that their costs would increase and that price was viewed as a sign of quality, they created a survey with mock product pages, randomly assigning customers to different price points. They found that the likelihood of purchase increased up to prices around $100, then plateaued and dropped in higher ranges. They tested different website designs with friends to see what would generate not only the most clicks, but also the strongest trust. Since other companies could sell glasses online, the founders realized that branding would be critical to their success. To name the company, they spent 6 months generating ideas, building a spreadsheet with more than 2,000 potential names. They tested their favorites in surveys and focus groups, finding that the Kerouac-inspired name of Warby Parker sounded sophisticated and unique and evoked no negative associations. Then they brought passion for execution in spades. Much of Warby Parker's recent success is due to the way they involved peers in evaluating ideas. In 2014, they created a program called Warbles, inviting everyone in the company to submit suggestions and requests for new technology features at any time. Before Warbles was introduced, they had received 10 to 20 idea submissions per quarter. With the new program, the number of submissions jumped to nearly 400, as employees trusted that the idea selection process was meritocratic. One of the suggestions led to the company's overhauling how they conducted retail sales. Another led to a new booking system for appointments. "Neil and Dave are really brilliant," says Warby Parker's chief technology officer, Lon Binder. "But there's no way they can be as brilliant as 200 people combined." Instead of limiting access to the ideas and leaving it up to managers to decide which ones to pursue and implement, Warby Parker made the suggestions completely transparent in a Google document. Everyone in the company could read them, comment on them online, and discuss them in a biweekly meeting. This means that, just as Justin Berg recommends, the ideas are evaluated not only by managers, but also by fellow creators, who tend to be more open to radically novel ideas. The time employees spend generating ideas makes them better at discerning which suggestions from their colleagues are worthwhile. The technology teams have full discretion to sort through the requests and start working on the ones that interest them. It sounds like a democracy, but there's one twist. To give employees some guidance on which suggestions represent strategic priorities for the company, managers vote the promising ones up and the bad ones down. To avoid false positives and false negatives, the votes aren't binding. Technology teams can overrule managers by selecting a request that didn't receive a lot of votes and work to prove its value. They don't wait for permission to start building something, says applied psychology expert Rev Rebel, who has worked on a study at Warby Parker. But they gather feedback from peers before rolling things out to customers. They start fast and then slow down. Had the Segway been submitted to the Warbles process, a lot more critical feedback might have rolled in to prevent it from being made, or to generate a more useful design. Before it was too late, Dean Kamen would have learned to make it practical, or licensed the technology to someone who could. The Segway may have failed, but Kamen is still a brilliant inventor. Jeff Bezos is still a visionary entrepreneur. And John Doerr is still a shrewd investor. Whether you're generating or evaluating new ideas, the best you can do is measure success on the kind of yardstick that batters use in baseball. As Randy Komisar puts it, "If I'm hitting 300, I'm a genius. That's because the future cannot be predicted. The sooner you learn it, the sooner you can be good at it." Dean Kamen has moved on to unveil a series of new inventions, back in the healthcare space where he made his original mark. There's a prosthetic arm with advanced robotics technology that makes it possible for a soldier or amputee to pick up a grape and operate a hand drill, nicknamed Luke after a Star Wars scene in which Skywalker gets a bionic arm. There's a new Stirling engine, a quiet, fuel-efficient machine for generating power and heating water. That engine powers the Slingshot water purifier, which can distill drinking water from any source, needs no filter, and can run on cow dung as a source of fuel. Kamen came full circle when he pitched the Slingshot to Komisar. Once again, though, Komisar is skeptical. Having traipsed around the developing world with a backpack himself, He thinks the machinery is too complicated for off-the-grid installations. When it stops working, it will wind up in a garbage heap. Whether this is an accurate forecast or a false negative remains to be seen. As an inventor, Kamen's best bet is to blindly generate novel ideas and gather more feedback from fellow creators to hone his vision about which ones might prove useful. As an investor, you'll be able to see more clearly, but you'll still be making one-eyed gambles. Instead of banking on a single idea, your wisest move might be to bet on a whole portfolio of Kamen's creations. In 2013 alone, over 300,000 patents were granted in the United States. The chances that any one of these inventions will change the world are tiny. Individual creators have far better odds over a lifetime of ideas. When we judge their greatness, we focus not on their averages, but on their peaks. Chapter 3. Out on a Limb. Speaking Truth to Power. Great spirits have always encountered opposition from mediocre minds. Albert Einstein. In the early 1990s, a high-flying CIA analyst named Carmen Medina went to Western Europe on a 3-year assignment. When she returned to the United States, she found that leaving the country had set her career back. After getting stuck with one job after another that didn't fit her skills and aspirations, she searched for another way to contribute. She began attending working groups about the future of intelligence. During the course of her career at the CIA, Medina recognized a fundamental problem with communication in the intelligence community. The default system for sharing information was through finished intelligence reports, which were released once a day and difficult to coordinate across agencies. Analysts had no way of sharing insights as they emerged. Since knowledge was evolving constantly, it took too long for critical information to land in the right hands. With lives at stake and national security on the line, every second mattered. Each agency was effectively producing its own daily newspaper, and Medina saw a need for a dramatically different system that would allow for real-time updates to be shared between agencies. To break down the silos and speed up communication, she proposed something wildly countercultural. Instead of printing reports on sheets of paper, intelligence agencies ought to begin publishing their findings instantaneously and transmitting them over Intellink, the intelligence community's classified internet. Her colleagues quickly shot down her suggestion. Nothing like Medina's plan had ever been attempted before. The internet, they argued, was a threat to national security. Intelligence was a clandestine service for good reason. Under the current system, they could ensure that printed documents reached the designated recipient with the need to know. Electronic communications didn't seem secure in that way. If knowledge landed in the wrong hands, we would all be in jeopardy. Medina refused to back down. If the whole point of these groups was to explore the future, and she couldn't speak truth to power there, where could she? Having witnessed how the fax machine enabled more efficient information sharing, she was convinced that the digital revolution would ultimately shake up the intelligence world. She continued advocating for an internet platform that would allow the CIA to transmit intelligence back and forth with other agencies, like the FBI and NSA. Medina kept voicing her opinions, but no one listened. A senior colleague warned her, "Be careful what you're saying in these groups. If you're too honest and say what you really think, it will ruin your career." Soon, even her good friends started isolating themselves from her. Finally, fed up with the lack of respect she was receiving, Medina blew up and got into a shouting match that forced her to take 3 sick days and then start hunting for a new job. When she couldn't find outside work, she ended up in a staff position that took her away from the action, pretty much the only CIA job she could get. She stayed quiet for a while, but 3 years after her flameout, she decided to speak up again in support of an online system for real-time continuous reporting across agencies. Less than a decade later, Carmen Medina played an indispensable role in creating a platform called Intellipedia, an internal Wikipedia for intelligence agencies to access one another's knowledge. It was so radically at odds with CIA norms that, in the words of one observer, it was like being asked to promote vegetarianism in Texas. By 2008, Intellipedia was a key resource that intelligence agencies used for such wide-ranging challenges as protecting the Beijing Olympics and identifying the terrorists behind the Mumbai attacks. Within a few years, the site accrued over 500,000 registered users in the intelligence community, over 1 million pages, and 630 million page views, and won the Service to America Homeland Security Medal. "It's hard to overstate what they did," said one senior leader. "They made a major transformation almost overnight with no money, after other programs failed to achieve these results with millions of dollars in funding." Why did Medina fail in her first efforts at speaking up? And what enabled her to be heard the second time? In between, the world changed. The Internet gained widespread acceptance, and the September 11 terrorist attacks sounded an alarm for better coordination between intelligence agencies. But there was no online solution until Medina rose to become the Deputy Director of Intelligence at the CIA, which gave her the authority to back Intellipedia. To land that position, she needed to learn to communicate differently, to speak up in ways that won credibility instead of losing it. At some point, we've all considered voicing a minority opinion, protesting a policy that doesn't make sense, championing a novel way of doing things, or standing up for a disadvantaged group of people. This chapter is about when to speak up and how to do it effectively without jeopardizing our careers and relationships. What are the right times to raise our voices, and what steps can we take to get heard? Along with unpacking Carmen Medina's discoveries, you'll learn from an entrepreneur who pitches his companies upside down, and a manager who took on Steve Jobs. You'll see why the most supportive managers sometimes provide the least support, how gender and race influence voice, and why the photos we like of ourselves are the opposite of the ones we prefer of our friends. The goal is to explain how we can all reduce the risks of speaking up and gain the potential benefits of doing so. Power without status. Leaders and managers appreciate it when employees take the initiative to offer help, build networks, gather new knowledge, and seek feedback. But there's one form of initiative that gets penalized: speaking up with suggestions. In one study across manufacturing, service, retail, and nonprofit settings, the more frequently employees voiced ideas and concerns upward, the less likely they were to receive raises and promotions over a 2-year period. And in an experiment, when individuals voiced their objections to racism, they were criticized as self-righteous by those who failed to speak out against it. When we climb up the moral ladder, it can be rather lonely at the top. To understand the barriers that Carmen Medina encountered, we need to tease apart two major dimensions of social hierarchy that are often lumped together: power and status. Power involves exercising control or authority over others. Status is being respected and admired. In an experiment led by University of North Carolina professor Allison Fregale, people were punished for trying to exercise power without status. When people sought to exert influence but lacked respect, others perceived them as difficult, coercive, and self-serving. Since they haven't earned our admiration, we don't feel they have the right to tell us what to do, and we push back. This is what happened to Carmen Medina. Her years overseas left her with little status. She hadn't had the opportunity to prove her worth to her colleagues, so they didn't give her ideas any credence. As people dismissed her concerns, she felt her frustration mounting. When we're trying to influence others, and we discover that they don't respect us, it fuels a vicious cycle of resentment. In an effort to assert our own authority, we respond by resorting to increasingly disrespectful behaviors. The most shocking demonstration of this vicious cycle occurred when researchers asked people to work on a task in pairs and gave one person power over what tasks the other would have to carry out to earn a shot at a $50 bonus. When the power holders were randomly assigned to learn that their peers admired and respected them, they chose mostly reasonable assignments. For the $50 bonus, their peers would have to tell a funny joke or write about their experiences the previous day. But when power holders learned that their peers looked down on them, they retaliated by setting up some humiliating tasks, such as telling their partners to bark like a dog 3 times, say, "I am filthy" 5 times, or count backward from 500 in increments of 7. Just being told that they weren't respected nearly doubled their chances of using their power in ways that degraded others. Carmen Medina didn't go nearly that far, but as she continued speaking up, her effort to exercise power without status elicited increasingly negative reactions. Status cannot be claimed. It has to be earned or granted. During her second effort, years later, Medina didn't put her career on the line by attempting to attack the system from below. Instead, she aimed to earn status by becoming part of the system and then changing it from within. As iconic filmmaker Francis Ford Coppola observed, "The way to come to power is not always to merely challenge the establishment, but first make a place in it and then challenge and double-cross the establishment." When Medina made the risky choice to present her idea again, she stabilized her risk portfolio by applying for a job that focused on information security. Her primary role was to keep knowledge safe. "That's not something I would have normally gone for. It was a very conservative thing," she remembers. "The other things I had to do with the security of our publications didn't excite me. But I could eventually use this in a smaller way to do the things I wanted to get done." Way down at the bottom of the list of responsibilities was to begin to explore digital publication options for the things that we were trying to keep secure. "I had this very conservative top cover. It was a balanced risk portfolio." Earlier, her case for sharing information over the Internet sounded like a security threat. Now she was able to frame it as part of her mission to protect security. "People saw that I stood for something, not just against the status quo. I thought that if I proved myself in that position, I would get a chance to start planting the seeds for even bigger change." As Medina gained respect for these efforts, she accumulated what psychologist Edwin Hollander called idiosyncrasy credits, the latitude to deviate from the group's expectations. Idiosyncrasy credits accrue through respect, not rank. They're based on contributions. We squash a low-status member who tries to challenge the status quo, but tolerate and sometimes even applaud the originality of a high-status star. In a recent experiment led by Silvia Bellezza, people rated male professors at top universities as having 14% more status and competence when they donned a t-shirt and a beard than when they wore a tie and were clean-shaven. Most professors dress formally, and refusing to follow the norm usually carries a cost. Those who successfully buck convention signal that they've earned the idiosyncrasy credits to do as they please. After Carmen Medina took the job in security, she spent the next few years making major progress in the digital arena. By doing work that advanced the CIA's mission, she earned the idiosyncrasy credits to champion her vision for knowledge sharing. She was promoted to the executive level. In 2005, Sean Dennehy and Don Burke, two CIA analysts from different parts of the agency, joined forces to help create Intellipedia, a classified variation on Wikipedia that would be accessible across the intelligence community. Many managers were skeptical of the value of a wiki for cross-agency information sharing.
Trying to implement these tools in the intelligence community is basically like telling people their parents raised them wrong, Dennehy admitted. They were turned down at every stage until they found Carmen Medina, who had quietly been building a network of rebels within the CIA. She provided the senior-level support that their fledgling effort needed, securing a space for them to introduce the concept of open source to a culture built upon secrecy. Since Medina had power, she no longer had to worry as much about how she voiced her ideas. But along the way, to earn the status that eventually gave her power, she did have to alter the way she spoke. Her shift in strategy shares something with the most bizarre startup pitch you might ever encounter. Putting your worst foot forward. The Sarek Effect. After having their first child, Rufus Griscom and Elisa Volkman were appalled by the amount of false advertising and bad advice being offered about parenting. They started an online magazine and blog network called Babble to challenge the dominant parenting cliches and tackle the cold, hard truth with humor. In 2009, when Griscom pitched Babble to venture capitalists, he did the exact opposite of what every entrepreneur has been taught to do. He presented a slide listing the top five reasons not to invest in his business. This should have killed his pitch. Investors are looking for reasons to say yes, and here he was, hand-delivering a list of reasons to say no. Entrepreneurs are supposed to talk about the upsides of their companies, not the downsides. But his counterintuitive approach worked. That year, Babble brought in $3.3 million in funding. 2 years later, Griscom made a sales visit to Disney to see if they might be interested in acquiring Babble. For this pitch, it would logically have been unthinkable to lead with the downsides. It's one thing to admit that your startup has problems. You can promise to fix the flaws. But when you're selling an established company, you have every incentive to emphasize the silver linings, and you're not going to stick around long enough to do anything about the clouds. Strangely, though, Griscom did it again. One of his slides read, "Here's why you should not buy Babble." Presenting to the family division of digital at Disney, he explained that user engagement at less than 3 page views per visit was lower than expected. Babble was supposed to be a parenting website, but 40% of the posts were about celebrities. And the back end of the website was in sore need of retooling. Disney ended up buying the company for $40 million. This is called the Sarek Effect, named after the social scientist Leslie Sarek. In both situations, Griscom was presenting ideas to people who had more power than he had, and trying to convince them to commit their resources. Most of us assume that to be persuasive, we ought to emphasize our strengths and minimize our weaknesses. That kind of powerful communication makes sense if the audience is supportive. But when you're pitching a novel idea or speaking up with a suggestion for change, your audience is likely to be skeptical. Investors are looking to poke holes in your arguments. Managers are hunting for reasons why your suggestion won't work. Under those circumstances, for at least 4 reasons, it's actually more effective to adopt Griscom's form of powerless communication by accentuating the flaws in your idea. The first advantage is that leading with weaknesses disarms the audience. Marketing professors Marion Freestad and Peter Wright find that when we're aware that someone is trying to persuade us, we naturally raise our mental shields. Rampant confidence is a red flag, a signal that we need to defend ourselves against weapons of influence. In the early days of Babble, when Griscom presented at the first 2 board meetings, he talked about everything that was going right with the business, hoping to excite the board about the company's momentum and potential. Every time I would say something emphasizing the upside, I would get skeptical responses, he recalls. Unbridled optimism comes across as salesmanship. It seems dishonest somehow, and as a consequence, it's met with skepticism. Everyone is allergic to the feeling,
or suspicious of being sold. At the third meeting of the board, Griscom reversed his approach, opening with a candid discussion of everything that was going wrong with the company and what was keeping him up at night. Although this tactic might be familiar in a debate, it was highly unconventional for an entrepreneur. Board members, though, responded much more favorably than they had in previous meetings, shifting their attention away from self-defense and toward problem-solving. Griscom decided to try the same approach with investors and noticed a similar reaction. They let their guard down. When I put up a slide that says, "Here's why you shouldn't buy this company," the first response was laughter. Then you could see them physically relax. It's sincere. It doesn't smell, feel, or look anything like sales. They're no longer being sold. In her first attempts at speaking up, Carmen Medina failed to acknowledge the limitations of her ideas. She stated it as a fact that the intelligence community needed to share information more openly, making a dangerous argument that solely stressed the benefits of transparency. One friend confided, "Carmen, you talk as if you won't be happy until everyone accepts what you say as the truth." In the second round of speaking up, a few years later, she became much more balanced in her presentations, aiming to express that little bit of doubt by saying, "Maybe I'm wrong." After Medina advanced to a leadership position, she found herself on the receiving end of pitches. When people only touted the pluses of their ideas, she quickly concluded that this idea is full of holes, they really haven't thought it through, and they've constructed their slide deck to keep me from figuring it out. When people presented drawbacks or disadvantages, I would become an ally. Instead of selling me, they've given me a problem to solve. Along with changing the frame of the interaction, being forthright about faults alters how audiences evaluate us. In a fascinating experiment, Teresa Amabile asked people to gauge the intelligence and expertise of book reviewers. She wondered whether adjusting the tone of reviews would change people's judgments of the critics. She took actual book reviews from the New York Times and edited them so the content was identical, but the evaluations were either flattering or scathing. Half of the participants were randomly assigned to read a positive review. In 128 inspired pages, Alvin Harder, with his first work of fiction, shows himself to be an extremely capable young American author. A Longer Dawn is a novella, a prose poem, if you will, of tremendous impact. It deals with elemental things, life, love, and death, and does so with such great intensity that it achieves new heights of superior writing on every page. The other half read a harsh version of the same review, in which Amabile left the language intact but substituted some adjectives that were critical rather than complimentary. In 128 uninspired pages, Alvin Harder, with his first work of fiction, shows himself to be an extremely incapable young American author. A Longer Dawn is a novella, a prose poem, if you will, of negligible impact. It deals with elemental things, life, love, and death, but does so with such little intensity that it achieves new depths of inferior writing on every page. Which version makes the reviewer sound smarter? They should be equal. The quality of the reviewer's prose hasn't changed. The vocabulary is comparable, and so is the grammatical structure. It took the same level of ability to write both versions. But people rated the critical reviewer as 14% more intelligent and having 16% greater literary expertise than the complimentary reviewer. People think an amateur can appreciate art, but it takes a professional to critique it. Merely changing a handful of words from positive to negative, inspired to uninspired, capable to incapable, tremendous impact to negligible impact, great intensity to little intensity, and heights of superior writing to depths of inferior writing, was sufficient to make the critical reviewer sound smarter. Prophets of doom and gloom appear wise and insightful, Amabile writes, while positive statements are seen as having a naive, Pollyanna quality. This is the second benefit of leading with the limitations of an idea. It makes you look smart. As you probably anticipated, this doesn't work if you're pitching a bad idea. Stanford psychologist Zach Tormala finds that audiences are more convinced when experts express doubt than certainty, due to the element of surprise. We expect an entrepreneur or a change agent to be certain. When they're not, we're intrigued, and we pay more attention to the message, which means we'll get on board if the idea is compelling. The Sarek effect only holds if you have a persuasive message to deliver. Rufus Griscom first discovered this early in his career, which started in publishing. There's nothing more shameful than writing a review that's too positive, he learned. Even if reviewers loved a book, they felt an obligation to add a paragraph at the end, noting where it fell short. According to Griscom, it's their way of saying, I'm not a chump. I was not totally snowed by this author. I am discerning. When he told investors about the problems with Babel, he demonstrated that he wasn't snowed by his own ideas or trying to snow them. He was a shrewd judge of his shortcomings. He was smart enough to do his homework and anticipate some of the problems that they would spot. The third advantage of being upfront about the downsides of your ideas is that it makes you more trustworthy. When Griscom described the hurdles he faced in his own business, he came across not only as knowledgeable, but also as honest and modest. Of course, highlighting weaknesses can backfire if the audience doesn't already recognize them. It can give them ammunition to shoot down your idea. But Griscom's audiences were already skeptical, and they were going to find out about many of the problems anyway, during due diligence. The job of the investor is to figure out what's wrong with the company. By telling them what's wrong with the business model, I'm doing some of the work for them. It established trust, Griscom explains. And speaking frankly about the weaknesses of the business, in turn made him more credible when he talked about the strengths. You need confidence to be humble, to front-run your weaknesses, Griscom says. If I'm willing to tell them what's wrong with my business, investors think, there must be an awful lot that's right with it. Disney came to trust Griscom so much that after they bought Babel, they brought him on board to run the business unit for 2 years as vice president and general manager, where he played a key role in developing Disney Interactive's digital strategy. The Sarek effect strikes again. A fourth advantage of this approach is that it leaves audiences with a more favorable assessment of the idea itself, due to a bias in how we process information. To illustrate this bias, I often ask executives to judge how happy they are after thinking about the positive features of their lives. One group is tasked with writing 3 good things about their lives. Another group has to list 12 good things. Everyone expects the 12 group to be happier. The more blessings you count, the better you should feel about your circumstances. But most of the time, the opposite is true. We're happier after we list 3 good things than 12. Why would this be? Psychologist Norbert Schwartz has shown that the easier it is to think of something, the more common and important we assume it is. We use ease of retrieval as information. It's a cinch for executives to come up with 3 good things about their lives. They immediately list their love of their children, their spouses, and their jobs. Since it was a breeze to generate a few positives, they infer that their lives are pretty darn good. It's noticeably harder to name 12 good things about their lives. After covering family and work, executives often mention their friends and then ask if they can count each one separately. Having struggled to come up with a dozen good things, they draw the conclusion that their lives aren't quite so good after all. Since I feel guilty about skewing their life satisfaction judgments, I counterbalance the exercise by asking the executives to name 3 or 12 bad things about their lives. Naming 3 bad things is easy. It leaves us thinking that life isn't so great. But it's actually pretty challenging to come up with a dozen things that are wrong, which leads to the realization that life could be a whole lot worse. Another way to make the point is to ask people to judge